Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Why are you sitting there in the dark? Kelly, 16, was standing in the doorway of her friend Megan's room. Oh, Megan looked up, surprised. Sometimes when I feel overwhelmed, I just turn out the lights and sit on the floor. It's sort of like instant peace and quiet.
So is closing your eyes and plugging your ears, retorted Kelly. What's the difference?
I can't exactly describe it, Megan took a deep breath. But when I sit in the quiet, I feel a little outside myself. I can kind of step away from what's bugging me.
Kelly plunked herself down on Megan's bed. I used to feel like that when I was a kid and my mom made me say my prayers before bed. It was sort of like everyone I cared for would somehow be okay. She grimaced. That's certainly long gone.
Well, Megan pulled herself up and joined Kelly on her bed. Maybe there's some other way you could capture that feeling. Sounds like it was kind of nice.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about how teens need and find spirituality? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest today has worked with teens in a spiritual context. Rabbi Sid Schwartz has been a congregational rabbi, a social entrepreneur and author, and a political activist. He founded and led PANIM, the Institute for Jewish Leadership and Values, an organization dedicated to inspiring, training, and empowering Jewish youth to a life of leadership, activism, and service. He's the founding rabbi of a Dat Shalom Reconstructionist congregation in Bethesda, Maryland, where he continues to teach and lead services. Rabbi Schwartz is the author of many articles and two groundbreaking books, Finding a Spiritual Home, How a New Generation of Jews Can Transform the American Synagogue, and Judaism and Justice, The Jewish Passion to Repair the World. In 2007, Rabbi Schwartz was named by Newsweek as one of the 50 most influential rabbis in North America. Currently, he serves as a senior fellow at KLAL, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. He's also the director of a national interfaith social justice project called Faith and the Common Good. Rabbi Schwartz is the father of three grown children. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Rabbi Schwartz.
Thank you.
What would you say is the biggest myth about teens and spirituality?
I'd say the biggest myth is the use of the term. Spirituality is a term that's become very hot in the marketplace. You find shelf fulls of books in bookstores, national news magazines feature it. In my experience with teens, they are moving into that space, but they don't necessarily resonate to the term spirituality. It's one of these adult terms that we want to put on a category of the population, in this case, teens. At the same time, the behaviors that teens manifest would clearly fall under the rubric of what we would call spirituality, largely defined. What teens are really interested in is finding who they are in the world. They're very eager to try to identify themselves as distinct from their parents, their teachers, the context they've grown up in. Psychologists call this process individuation. Who am I opposite everyone else who formed me, so to speak, who influenced my thinking, my values, and the like? And that, of course, leads to some tension. The whole notion of how teens relate to the issue of spirituality, they really want to make an impact on the world. And they're trying to find, what am I destined to be? And that is a question that is essentially one of the largest questions that teens are wrestling with. And some deal with it better than others. For some, as early as the teen years, teens start to find their path. Other teens don't start finding any direction, and they find themselves needing to grab onto others, groups, and whatever else to define themselves.
Why can spiritual discovery be appealing to teens, since that is in a different realm than sort of the everyday bricks and mortar of building your life?
I think it is about self-discovery. What are my gifts? So the process of self-discovery is to find, you know, what is it that I'm good at? What is it that I can contribute to the world that will make me unique? And that is something that teens are constantly dealing with. And we know that teens are very peer-driven.
This whole business, though, of the discovery of what's outside yourself and this whole business of there's something greater than me, how does that fit with teens trying to find themselves?
Let me try and define spirituality the way I use the term, okay? Many people relate to spirituality in religious / theological contexts, and that is one way to think about spirituality. But if we're going to use the term, I define spirituality as a sense of connectedness both vertical and horizontal. What I mean by that is the vertical connection is a sense of being connected to some greater power in the universe. Some call it God. Others want to use other terms. The interest that's been going on now for decades in Eastern religions is that there's a sense of transcendence that's not connected to the kind of personal God that is the convention of Western religions, right? Eastern religions have a sense that God is pervasive, that there's a God experience all around us, and it's not a proper noun, but simply an aspect of the universe. So that's the vertical connection. The horizontal connection is that, which is also a spiritual dynamic, is how do I feel connected to a cause? And this is where a lot of my work has been in the realm of activism, social and political activism. So I find, and maybe because this is the kind of work that I focus mostly on, many teens find their purpose connecting themselves to a movement. It may be the environmental movement. It may be a human rights movement. It may be the cause in Darfur. It may be poverty in the backyard. It may be a homelessness issue. And when young people find that they can work on issues like that, it connects them to a larger sense of purpose. And that, too, is a spiritual connection.
What part does a family's religious identification and observance then play in a teen's life?
It's complicated. So the first thing I want to say, let me start from a broader category and then narrow down to affiliation with faith communities. First of all, if a teenager sees their parents involved in any kind of volunteer civic organization, PTA, coaching an athletic team, volunteering in a hospital, anything like that, there's already an important message being sent that part of what adults do in the world is give back, is they take some of their time, not just to raise their family, because they see that, not just to earn money and have an income, they see that as well, that's obvious, but to give back where there's no seeming material benefit, okay? That is the work of creating social capital. That's a term that was coined by Robert Putnam, who wrote Bowling Alone. Putnam observed quite accurately that we live in a society today in America where social capital has been on a dramatic decline. Many people are becoming so self-centered that there's less investment being made in social capital, and as a result, we're seeing a deterioration of our civic fabric, okay? So category A is when a teenager sees their parents involved in some kind of civic engagement, that's already a very powerful message that part of what it means to be a mature adult is to give back to society. Now, when that involvement is with a faith community, synagogue, church, mosque, there are some additional value addeds, okay? So number one, you have a very clear sense that that faith community is involved with a certain set of values. Now, they are specific values in faith communities, but there are also some general overarching ones. Compassion, respect, tolerance, seeing other people made in the image of God and treating them accordingly. These are important overarching values, and one of the things that teens need very desperately is to have some bedrock of values and principles that guide what they do, because they are increasingly identifying themselves outside of the household. If they don't have those strong values, they're going to be adrift, morally adrift. B, most faith communities have a strong sense of cultural and ethnic history. So there's a sense of, I'm connected to something that has been around for a very long time. I remember at Panim, we did an annual contest for our alumni, and we saw tens of thousands of young people over the course of over 20 years. And our award was the Young Jewish Activist of the Year. So I remember a young person, this is just to illustrate this issue of what does it mean to be connected to a historical memory. So one year, a young woman won the award. She was from West Palm Beach, Florida. Her name was Liz Dwoskin. And she went to a charter high school which specialized in the arts. After she came back from our program, she was very motivated to see how could she make a contribution to teens of her age who were less fortunate than she. And she identified in West Palm Beach, Florida, that not too far from her own school was a school with at-risk population, much lower income, which had none of the opportunities that her school provided for cultural arts and the like. So she mobilized dozens of her friends to go to the school on a regular basis and provide music and art and poetry and drawing, which they were doing on a volunteer basis. And they brought a whole cultural arts program to a school that had nothing. Fast forward, What happens when a young person wins the award, we bring them to our annual benefit dinner held in the spring every year in Washington, D.C. And when she got up to give her speech, she said the following, and I paraphrase. She said, my organization is called Panim. She says, Panim didn't teach me to be good. She said, I'd already gotten that influence from my parents and teachers and the like. She said, I was already on that path. But what Panim did was connect me to a story which connected me to Abraham and Sarah and to a people that have been trying to do good in the world for centuries. Now, so what's happened there? What was she observing? She was saying that somehow something that she was already predisposed to be engaged in was part of a larger story, and as a result, her life took on larger meaning. So there's that second aspect of when a family is in a faith community, there's a sense of how can they connect to the history of that faith community. And the third element, so values is one, two is the notion of historical memory, and third is a sense of transcendence, okay, God talk. And the notion that there is some larger purpose in the universe and that somehow you need to align your life with that larger purpose, whether we call it God's will or some grand design, is also part of feeling that sense of connectedness. And I go back to my definition of spirituality, that vertical connection. I'm connected to something that has been around for a long time and was here before I was born, will be here after I die.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on spirituality for teens.
Popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Rabbi Sid Schwarz about spirituality for teens. Now, what happens when a family has no religious identification?
Let me first say that conventional religious practice is not the forte of teens, okay? So even when a family is connected to a faith community, for them, it would be unrealistic to expect that they're going to be following their parents at age 14, 15, 16 into church or synagogue. It just doesn't happen that way. Or if it happens, it usually happens under duress, okay? And there are reasons for that, because most conventional religious institutions are seen by teens as very conventional, very stuffy. They don't get the ritual and its meaning that much. It's very adult-centered. And furthermore, it strikes teens as overly insular. Teens today are increasingly global in their consciousness. So anything that smacks of insularity is something that they will push away. So even when families are connected to faith communities, you don't find conventional religious practice in teens being manifested. With that said, I do think that when, as I said earlier, when a family is connected and spending time in a faith community, it sends a message which will pay back dividends later on in different ways. When a family is not connected to a faith community at all, I don't think that dooms a teenager or a child, a life of, you know, drifting, rudderless in a complex world. That's not the case. It may happen, but it could happen just as well to a young person raised in a family committed to faith and part of the faith community. There's a Yiddish saying, man plans and God laughs, which means that for all our planning, there's some larger design that's going to happen whether you like it or not, okay? So don't try to oversteer this ship, you know, if you're a parent, right? And I think most parents, especially conscientious parents, if they err, they err on the side of oversteering. And sometimes you need to pull back a little bit. So here's what's great about God's sense of humor. So I've seen many, many families with a lot of young people and a lot of people coming to me in their 20s and 30s as singles or newly married, whatever else. And it's astounding how many people I see coming to synagogues, that's my experience, who were raised with no religion whatsoever. I mean, they could say, you know, one of my parents was Jewish, but I wasn't raised in a synagogue. I didn't have a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah. And I know this to be the case also in the Christian world as well. In other words, simply because you don't have that religious background doesn't mean that you will never find your way to a faith community. And I think that phenomenon actually may accelerate. And here's my theory. The world that teens live in today is overconnected. We are in the Facebook era. And the phenomenon is that there's no longer a realm of privacy. Every activity is shared with your network. Every thought is shared with your network. even the most private things in your life, like your body. I actually think there's going to be a reaction to all this. It's still all the fae. And yet, at a certain point, you realize that just because you can list 1,000 friends on Facebook, you may have no one that you can speak to in confidence who is really your friend. And religion, when it works, faith communities, when they work, help people find what it means to find sacred space, what it means to actually have relationships in real time, face-to-face with people who will support you and who really are your friends, who care about your well-being. That's very different than the phenomenon that most teens work in, which is it's virtual friendship. And there's a reason you turn the word virtual there, because it's oftentimes not real. It's only virtual. So it seems like you have a lot of friends, but in the end, you don't have that sense of confident, private, sacred space where there are people you can rely on. I'm not sure that correlation between is a family affiliated with the faith community and is the child then on the right path or not. It's not that simple. It's not a straight line.
How do you give teens a sense of connection and purpose?
Well, a lot of the work that we've done through Panim is to help young people see that they can have a dramatic impact on their communities, their country, and their world, on the issues that they see happening every day. You know, one of the things about democracy is that it depends on people believing that they can have an impact on the course of their society, okay? If you look at totalitarian countries, I spent some time back in the good old days of the Soviet Union. I made some visits. I was very active in the movement to free Soviet Jews. And when I had my occasional exchanges with ordinary Soviets, they didn't feel that their lives could in any way impact the larger society. It was going to be run by the Politburo, by the handful of oligarchs that ran the country. Now, America is different. America really does believe that citizens can make a difference, but that waxes and wanes depending on the moment. And frankly, we live in a time where there's a great deal of suspicion about government and whether ordinary citizens can make a difference. So a large part of the work that I've done for decades now is to help young people understand what their role can be as citizen activists. And what I've seen is just remarkable. Teens who simply, with a little bit of exposure to the ways of Washington, to the ins and outs of some of the debates that shape our country, really seize upon an issue and make a tremendous difference. And you never know what's going to trigger the passion of a young person. In some cases, it may be environmental activism. In other cases, it could be something like a human rights issue. There was a young person, a quick story, a young man named Ben Ross, who was another winner of our activist award, came to one of our programs and decided he had already done a little bit of activism around Darfur because before he came to our program, he did a restaurant fundraiser where he got four or five restaurants to agree to give 20% of everyone he would bring in and he would contribute to Darfur. So he raised several hundred dollars. Nice. But after our program, it went to a whole new level. He began to organize all the students in Montgomery County, Maryland, to come to the county council where a bill was crafted that he had a hand in crafting. He found a county council person to work with him because it turned out that somewhere between $10 to $15 million of county pension funds was invested in Sudanese-related corporations, mostly Chinese. And he wanted to create a divestment movement, which was happening nationally, but he localized it to the place that he lived. And he not only was involved with crafting the legislation, getting it introduced as a piece of legislation. He then packed the county council hearing room with dozens of teens from every school in the district to pack the council chambers when they had the vote, and it passed. So here, a young person who's a senior in high school had an ability to pass legislation that resulted in the divestment of between $10 to $15 million of pension funds. It's remarkable. Now, this young man, you know, found a purpose. And there are dozens of such stories of young people who've gotten involved.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on spirituality for teens.
For an audio CD of any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parent's Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We're talking with Rabbi Sid Schwarz about spirituality for teens.
I'll give you one other story. Another young woman named Jackie Rotman was from Santa Barbara, California. It turns out that she had experience when she came to us. She was about 15 years old. She had taken dance lessons from the time she was probably 7, 8 years old and was quite talented. Not that I ever saw her dance. I took her word for it. But when she went back home, she again tried to think about, how can I give back? She became aware for the first time, because so many of our middle-class kids are raised in bubbles. And so when they come to our program, we actually work hard to make them see what Michael Harrington called the other America, the America that doesn't look like them, that's not middle class, that's not comfortable. So she says, how can I give back to that population? So she teamed up with a local middle school to start providing dance lessons to middle school girls, mostly Latino and some African American. And she called the program Everybody Dance Now. Now, in the year after our program, they were teaching, she and a couple of friends, about 60 girls a week. 2 years later, I was invited to be a guest speaker in her community, Santa Barbara, and I called up her father, and I said, I know Jackie's now in college, but is Everybody Dance Now still happening? He says, when you land at the airport, I want to pick you up. I'm going to bring you to see what's going on. So I land at the airport. Her dad picks me up at the airport, drives me to a middle school, and I find out that in the 2 years since I knew about the story, Jackie not only had her program replicate itself in schools all across the county, but she had helped train other teenagers because she knew she was going off to college. And now they were reaching over 600 girls a week in programs. And I went to one of the programs where I actually participated in a class that was still ongoing. Now, this was from one young person. So if you say, you know, how do you find help teens find meaning and purpose? I can tell you so many stories of young people like Jackie and Ben who, with just a little bit of encouragement, can really find a purpose which will shape the rest of their lives. You see, what's strange about teens, they are a strange species. But under the sense of bravado and cynicism oftentimes, there's a deep well of altruism which doesn't often enough get tapped in our society. If we can find ways to tap into that altruism, it's amazing what young people can do. And that's really what I think we need to focus in our schools, in our homes, in our churches and synagogues, find ways to tap into that deep well of altruism that teens have that tells them that they can make a difference and that that's part of what they're destined to do with their lives.
How do you do that if you don't have an organization to do it through?
You know, one of the things that happened over the past few decades, and Panim was part of the phenomenon, there is now a wholesale societal buy-in to the notion of community service. You have more and more high schools that make community service a requirement for graduation. We tapped into that big time. And as a result, there is money out there through the federal government and through state allocations as well to provide numerous opportunities for volunteering one's time in one's own community. And I think that kind of experience is one of the trigger points. There was a study done I saw recently from the University of British Columbia, and they wanted to see what determined the happiness/fulfillment quotient of young people, teens and young adults. They found no correlation between religious commitment and happiness fulfillment, but they found a very strong correlation between experiences of volunteerism, service, and acts of kindness and happiness fulfillment. So it could be, and I would hope, that we can create faith communities that are vehicles for that kind of experience of giving back, community service, and the like. Not every faith community does that. But it's clear that in this one study, it's the latter. It's the giving back, the volunteer service, the becoming face-to-face with people who are different than you that really makes young people get a sense about what they need to do in the world.
Rabbi Schwarz, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue this topic further?
So I'll mention two of my own books and then a few other wonderful resources. I wrote a book called Finding a Spiritual Home. My other book is called Judaism and Justice, The Jewish Passion to Repair the World. A few other resources that I would recommend. Robert Coles wrote a wonderful book called The Spiritual Life of Children. There's another book called Be the Change, subtitled Change the World, Change Yourself, by Michelle Nunn, the daughter of Sam Nunn, who was a senator from Georgia. Michelle is the head of the Hands-On Network, which is a national network of volunteerism. One of my favorite books for teens, but I think parents would do well to peek at it. It will help them be better parents, is a book written by the son of Stephen Covey. Stephen Covey, well known for the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. His son, Sean, S-E-A-N, wrote a book called The Seven Habits of Highly Effective Teens. There's one of the book I'll mention, especially people who are committed Christians, by Tim Smith, called The Seven Cries of Today's Teens.
Well, this has been such an informative talk, and we have appreciated all the information that you've been able to give us and the insights. So, Rabbi Swirz, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Rabbi Swirz's book, Finding a Spiritual Home, How a New Generation of Jews Can Transform the American Synagogue. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 453 and tell us, if you can, what station you are tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. We often thank individuals or organizations for their generous donations that help with the cost of producing Parents' Perspective programming. Parents' Perspective Incorporated is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Donations can be made online through GiveDirect or iGive.com or MissionFish at eBay. Or you can send checks or money orders to Parents Perspective Incorporated, Post Office Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015. Thank you for helping us continue to work for you. Our sound engineer is Mark Vitelli. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.